Welcome to ShollyCast, the podcast all about Lolly and Shota, including Not Safe for Work. ShollyCast is hosted by me, Hydro, and Dr. X. We're the developers of Insexual Awakening, a straight Shota visual novel game with incest, lollies, MILFs, onesans, and even a femboy character if you play Insexual Awakening 2, our sequel. If you'd like to play our games, you can download them at our official Barag at barag.net/cyberhex. And if you'd like to support Insexual Awakening's continued development and this podcast, you can join our Subscribestar at subscribestar.adult/cyberhex. Enjoy the show. Welcome back to ShollyCast, everyone. I'm your host, Hydro, along with my co-host, Dr. X, once again. And for this episode, we are joined by Kevin Snowpaw. Welcome, Kevin.
Hello. It's good to be here.
Welcome.
Welcome, welcome. So you primarily do a lot of commissioning, and you've created like your own OC, and also you're just an enjoyer of Lolly Show, right?
Absolutely. And have been for a very, very long time.
How long would you say?
Oof. It's kind of hard to specify an exact time. I mean, if you want me to go full disclosure, I was attracted to this sort of stuff while I could have starred in this sort of stuff if I were a fictitious creature. So it never really went anywhere from there. It just sort of kept going in a straight line.
That's interesting because we've definitely had plenty of guests that have all said that they really got into it when they were pretty much a Lolly or Shota IRL. And were there any like particular characters or shows that kind of really ramped it up or kind of kept that momentum going, being interested in it?
Oof. So at the time, I didn't realize it, but absolutely. And then once I got a little bit older, I could look back and take a look at it and analyze it and go, yeah, that's where this came from. But I think probably it got started with an interest in characters in primarily Western animation, a lot of Disney Afternoons characters. Like, I have the most absurdly insatiable crush on Gosalind Mallard from Darkwing Duck, for example. So characters like that going forward kind of explains why I got into the whole furry thing. But then when I got a little bit older, I started, you know, hitting the time period where we were getting more and more Japanese animation showing on American television and stuff like that, like Digimon, Cardcaptors, stuff like that. And I started falling in love with a lot of those characters too.
You got the entire thing going. You liked the furry characters, and you also liked the human characters too.
Absolutely. Though I didn't quite recognize it until I was older. When I started hitting the age where you begin to become more cognizant of your attractions, I started recognizing that I was really attracted to characters like Sakura or Lisa Simpson. A little bit later on, I started realizing that I was really, really attracted to, and I'm sure you've heard this before, Tails.
Yep.
That's like furry Shota patient zero, basically, for most people. Yeah. Yep.
Tails is the gateway drug for furry. I mean, he really is.
Yes.
Like, you can be the straightest person on earth and still might have a little bit of a thing for Tails.
Yes. I've definitely seen that happen before.
Once I acknowledged that, I started tumbling down that rabbit hole too, no pun intended. And it just ballooned outwards from there, and I realized that I had a full and robust appreciation for both genres.
Can you talk about the first character you mentioned from, I think you said it was Darkwing Duck?
Gosalind Mallard.
Yes.
She's probably the origin point of my deep and abiding love of spunky tomboys. There was just something about Gosalind that carried the show. If you took her out of the show, it would have been terrible, even though it was about Darkwing. She was very much an almost like centrifugal point for the way that a lot of the plots revolved and a lot of the character development revolved. And she was just a really funny and interesting character. And the voice actress who did her was the same one who I believe did Chucky from Rugrats, which, looking back, that probably connects a few more dots for me that we can go into later. So yeah, just a huge fan of Goslin. Mostly the character itself was what pulled me in and got me really addicted to her. And then going forward, I started to deeply appreciate the design.
Are you familiar with Darkwing Duck, Dr. X? Have you ever watched it?
I know it has ducks in it.
Well, I do know of the character you're talking about, Kevin. And yeah, now that I think about it, yes. Like, and she does have like a bit of a like a raspy voice too, very much like Chucky did. So did have like tomboyish tendencies. And I think she had, did she have like reddish hair?
She had red, fire red pigtails, which is,
yes,
looking back, probably another dot connected.
Yeah, yep. So I definitely remember her character, like in the opening in particular, like when she jumps on Darkwing, like when he's in bed or something like that. And or like when Darkwing grabs her, like her beak, like shuts her mouth and stuff. I remember all that stuff.
Goslin's an absolute firecracker. And as the show goes on, she wants more and more and more to be a superhero like Darkwing. He's completely against it. And in a couple of episodes, she kind of gets to pull it off. They explore more of that in the comics. I would have loved to have seen a Darkwing Duck reboot, like they did with DuckTales. And then they did that cameo appearance where they sort of shoved Darkwing into the DuckTales reboot canon and completely butchered Goslin. She's an entirely different character.
Ugh. Oh, that's too bad.
Yeah, I mean, at that point, you don't even want a reboot if that's how they're going to approach the character, by totally gutting them, changing them.
Absolutely not. But thankfully, they changed her last name for the reboot. So, because she's no longer Darkwing's adopted daughter in the reboot, so she's just Goslin Wattlemyre. So I can separate the two characters. It's fine.
In what way do they ruin the character?
Well, they committed a cardinal sin, in my opinion, which is that they aged her up.
Oh, already deadly. Yeah.
Dead on arrival. They changed her hairstyle. They changed the coloration of her feathers for some reason. She kind of had like a yellowy white tone in the original, and now she's got almost more of like a dusky tone. Changed her outfit, changed her attitude. I mean, she's still kind of tomboyish, but she's more like, I hate to apply like a racial stereotype to an animated duck character, but if I had to, I'd say that the original Goslin was kind of like your typical Punky Brewster style, funky American tomboy. And the new Goslin kind of gives me like mild Latina vibes. And there's like nothing wrong with that, but it's definitely a shift in her character tone. There's just so many things that they changed about her. I just couldn't get into it.
So does she have like an accent now or something?
No, not really an accent. It's just sort of more like a... And maybe there's a little bit of an inflection there, because I think her new voice actress is. And you're going to pick up on that a little bit when you have changed voice actors, and there's no way of getting around that. Because unfortunately, the original actress is dead, which is tragic, because she's done so many of my favorite cartoon characters. If you look up the like Goslin Mallard voice actor and see that name of that voice actress, the list of characters she's done is just incredible, and you're going to recognize like almost all of them and go, oh my god, I love this character. So her loss was pretty horrible.
Yeah.
Now, fair is fair. The new girl they've got voicing Goslin does a fine job. It's just not my Goslin.
And I think you mentioned Chucky in Rugrats. Was there something you wanted to say about that?
Ooh, yeah. Let's see. I've got a pretty broad range of what I tend to find attractive, but on the lower end of the number spectrum, characters like Chucky tend to fit in. I don't know exactly what it is about Chucky, other than the voice actor, that really drew me in, but there was something about the character's mannerisms and designs that I just really fell in love with. He and Angelica became my favorite Rugrats pretty quick.
How much of Rugrats did you watch?
Most of it. I haven't seen the reboot that they did in CGI. I think that maybe I've caught like one or two episodes, but I don't think that would really count as having seen it. Grew up on it though.
You must know about the episode where they all get naked.
Oh yes. That was season 2, I believe. The episode was called Nakey Tommy.
You know, yes. The exact, I figure you would know the exact. Wow.
Yes.
Nice.
That's dedication. And yeah, I mean, it was notable back then when I was watching it as a younger person. But it feels even more notable now because like they would never fucking do that ever again.
Yeah, no, no.
Oh, no, probably not in today's market at all. And it was all very tastefully done. All bananas and apples and object placement and shots from behind. And as with a lot of stuff that happened in that show, it was tackling a subject that was intimately familiar to anyone who's ever been a parent. Pretty much every kid alive, when they're very little toddlers, will go through this phase where they suddenly can't stand their clothes and they will constantly find an excuse to shed them. And then usually right after that phase, they'll go through the opposite where like it's difficult to get them out of their clothes even for a bath, because they will suddenly go from being absolutely shameless to incredibly self-conscious. And I'm sure there's a deep psychology discussion we could go into there, but I'm not a psychologist, so I won't touch too much on it. But I think it's a good example of how our environments can influence our perception of reality and our bodies.
You know, I think you're right. It did touch up on that subject.
A lot of the episodes were just standard, parents will understand this, but let's tell this story from the perspective of the babies. And that's ultimately what made the show so successful.
Yep, you're right. Because the kids could enjoy, you know, the baby's antics, but then, you know, but as those kids got older and became parents, or like current parents are watching it, or they would understand like what the parents were going through and everything like that.
Well,
so it's smart, very smart, like show design. That's why it got so popular and was able to have so many, you know, a spinoff and all kinds of stuff.
And it was very much for the adults in the audience as well, too.
Yes.
Like they wrote the whole thing with that in mind. In case in point, that same episode, right after Tommy convinces everybody to strip down, Betty comes over, sees what's going on, freaks out, grabs Phil and Lil, runs for the door, looks at Dee and says, "The 60s are over, Dee, and we lost." And then she leaves. No one's going to get that reference except for the adults watching the show.
Yes, you're right about that. Well, at the time you had watched the episode, did you find it arousing?
So here's an interesting thing. Yes and no. When I first watched it, I was much, much younger. But I found it incredibly interesting. It pulled me in immediately and became one of my favorite episodes of the show. And it stuck in my brain. And it wasn't until later when I started reflecting on it and realizing that I had those feelings for the episode. But prior to that, there was a very almost visceral attraction to the concept it discussed in the show. And that's actually something I've flirted with since I was fairly young myself, was this almost casual approach to being exposed like that. I always really liked the idea, and I very much kind of had it beaten out of me by society as I got older. So when I saw that in Rugrats, I was like, this episode is amazing. Though I didn't really quite realize why until I was a little older.
I think that makes a lot of sense. I'm sure at the time you had seen the episode, society had already told you that being naked is wrong. So it probably felt very surprising and very interesting to have an episode where like the kids elect to all get naked. And I don't remember. Was Angelica one of them?
No, Angelica was not. Chucky, however, almost is, and that's when they walk in and see what's going on. He's like 8/10 of the way through. But I can tell this had a huge profound influence on me, because it's even affected a lot of the stuff that I have my character do in artwork and stuff. He's often depicted as a casual nudist.
Well, that's interesting. That is interesting, because it seems like maybe that episode had influenced you later on in life to be attracted to characters who are nudists, or like kind of nudist or naturalist situation.
It definitely fostered a continued development of an attraction to that concept. Not necessarily to like nudity for nudity's sake, but like the casual approach to it, or the concept of like that sort of thing. Like being a casual nudist or a naturist, or however you want to put the term, it definitely was something that I was interested in as a very young boy, and something that continued to develop through my tween and teen years, though it was never anything I personally got to explore. I did end up finding a medium in form of art and role play to do it.
So you've played the first game, and I assume you did everything, as most people do. So you probably know that once you get with everyone in the house, all the family members, everyone is naked in the house all the time.
Yeah. Was absolutely a high point in the game for me.
Yep. I remember when Dr. X and I had planned that out, we were just kind of like, you know, that'd actually be kind of fun if that's what they did. And I think it was you, Dr. X, that suggested it, if I recall.
Yes.
And it was just a lot of fun doing that. And you know, we do that in the sequel as well. At least with Robin, the mom. And you know, we can't spoil what future things hold for the game, but. You know, if you're a fan of that mechanic in the first game, well, you'll probably be a fan of what we have in store for IA 2.
There were some hints, picking up what you're putting down on another character's story arc that was not Robin, that I'm very excited for if those sort of come to fruition. So we will see, but I'm looking forward to finding out. But yeah, those little rebellions like that are something that I find a mixture of both exciting and a little arousing. But I think that also leads into some of my other like kinks that I've developed over the years is I kind of like, it sounds a little weird, but like cute feet, but I wouldn't say I have like a huge like thing for feet. It's more the fact that if they're small and cute and well-drawn and presented correctly, I think it's attractive. And I think that stemmed from like what I would consider like little rebellions is what I would call them. Like I'd be sitting in class and I would notice that like all the girls in class that had sandals on had taken their sandals off underneath the desks. And for some reason, I thought that was really cute. It's funny how the human mind can make these connections and draw these patterns to stuff and then link them to other emotions and feelings that would normally not be associated with those.
Absolutely. And I thought it was funny you said it was weird because like, we've had like full on foot fetishes on the podcast, so this is nothing, dude.
Oh, I figured, but I've been like, it's kind of like grown into like a mild kink for me at this point.
Right.
But it's never something that I would have initially like taken a look at and been like, oh yeah, this is what I want. Like, I don't think anybody rolls out of bed in the morning and goes, yes, today I want to be attracted to armpits. But it's just the way things are, and like I'm not, but like I know some people who are, so.
I totally get what you're saying, that like you like certain cute feet when they're well drawn, because you know Lolly Shota feet definitely have their own like characteristic compared to how like, you know, an adult's foot would look in artwork.
Oh yeah.
I mean, I know one of the goats is the artist that I work with, Highwear. He does phenomenal like feet,
right? Oh, yeah.
and stuff for Shotas and Lollies. So I totally get what you're saying there. Like, even if you're not super into feet, if they're extremely cute and well-drawn and, like, they appeal to the overall aesthetic of the character and, like, whatever pose they might be in. Like a pose I can think of is from the comic I first did with Highwear, Spoils of Victory. There is a pose where one of the Lolly twins is kind of... Or actually, they both are doing this. They're laying on their stomachs and... basically like her feet are kind of like up like as if she's like laying down, and it's just very, very cute and appealing.
Oh, absolutely. And I've noticed that there is almost like sort of this separation between what I would consider like full-on like fetish and sort of presentation. And if the fetish is very much being drawn as the focus, that it's both there. But even when the fetish isn't there, a lot of really, really good artists, both in Lolly Shota and in a lot of Cub work, will often present characters in positions where you can see like the bottoms of the feet, but like in a cute pose. That there's almost like this, like a level of attraction to the fact that they are exposed, not necessarily a level of attraction to them as a sex object, though obviously they are often presented that way as well.
I mean, I feel like with artists, well, when it, I get it, I get what you mean there too. I wonder if part of it is they're trying to like show off the character completely, but I also almost wonder if it's like a sense of pride for some artists to be able to be like, hey, I can draw feet and I can draw hands. I don't have to like crop them off and not show them because I don't know how to draw the toes right or whatever.
Feet and hands are easily the bane of almost every artist I've spoken to, except for the ones who excel at it. And even then, they'll usually say something modest like, yeah, I'm really bad at drawing feet and hands. I'm like, shut up. You are absolutely not.
That they may say they're bad at it, but then they show it in like every piece of artwork they have. So right? It's like, it's like, yeah, you may not be, you may say that you're not so great at it, but yet you show it in all your artworks. So that's still further than most people who are not confident with it and don't know how to do it. Now, you were saying prior to us starting the recording of the episode, you were saying that you're on Ink Bunny quite like that. That's kind of your go-to place, or at least it has been for a while. And I mean, you're still on Barrag and other communities, but Ink Bunny kind of is where you got your start with like your OC and stuff like that, I'm guessing.
Well, actually, no, it goes back a lot further than that. But I am primarily available on Ink Bunny. Like, if you want to see who is this, you know, people who are in the audience right now who know me are going to be like, yeah, I know Kevin, that's fine. But the people in the audience who may not be terribly familiar with Cub Art or furry stuff and are curious, if you want, you can go to inkbunny.net, sign up for an account for reasons of not accidentally exposing people who shouldn't be exposed to it, to the artwork that I get. I have it all behind, for the most part, the account wall. So make an account, flag yourself so that you can see adult content and all that. Visit my page, you'll see a ton of art, in case you're wondering who I am and what I look like. But it goes way back past that. I was originally on Fur Affinity before what we call the Great Purge, where they decided that they no longer wanted any kind of Cub content on the site, and kicked everyone off. Yep. And then they started censoring Digimon, and then they started censoring Pokemon, and now you can't even post artwork of like first generation unevolved Pokemon on FA without running the risk of getting a warning or a ban. Yay, Gestapo. But yeah, the origins of Kevin go back all the way to an old chat room that used to be on a furry website called Yifstar, which has been rebranded and changed hands, and now it's known as So Furry. But originally, it was Yifstar, and it had a chat program on it called YifChat, where you could make these chat rooms and roleplay as these characters, and that's where I really got my start, trying out different character facets, different things about the character that I liked. And I had like 3 or 4 different characters that I would routinely roleplay until I started realizing that I liked this about this character and this about that character. And I started mixing them together, and eventually Kevin came to be.
When you came up with the core look of Kevin, of that character, how did you like where did it start? Like, did you know it was going to be like a bunny character, like right away?
Not at first.
Ah, okay.
So again, as Tails is the gateway drug for most people into the furry fandom, the concept of making a fox persona is often the first thing you go to. So I created a completely safe for work fox persona that no one's ever seen or heard of, because he exists on the pages of a notebook somewhere where I was learning to draw. I'm not an artist, but I managed to create this character. And I think I role-played with him like once, but he was basically, you know, your bog-standard, cringy, teenage Sonic OC. So I guess in a way, good riddance.
I mean, I wonder how many of those kinds of Sonic OCs are on, like, pieces of notebook paper. There's probably thousands.
More than we could possibly know. More than there are stars in the sky. And there are people who take that Sonic OC to the next level and they make it their primary online character. And there is absolutely nothing wrong with that. I am actually friends with a couple of people who've done that. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to try and make something that was a little bit more unique, but wasn't too unique. We have a saying in the furry community where certain characters will be described as a sparkle dog. And that's basically a slang term for a character or OC that is like a winged husky, 4 tails and like a rainbow colored fur pattern and like leopard spots and just a ridiculous amount of, I threw everything at this character to make it unique. It looks like a Lisa Frank artist threw up all over it. Are you proud of me, Mom?
2 different colored eyes. Don't forget the 2 different colored
heterochromia.
Eyes.
Heterochromia. the paw pads are all a different color.
Okay, that's going really far into
an absolute freaking nightmare to draw, and most artists will take one look at that and go, oh yeah, I'm full on commissions right now. Honestly, I just filled up, I'm sorry. More so than in the Lolly Show community and the Bird community, a lot of these people have a personal attachment to the character that they have created. It is very much them, or an idealized version of them.
Right. Well,
like a mask or persona. So I can see why they could be so particular about it. But getting back to the original question, that's something I wanted to avoid in Kevin's design. I wanted him to be like me, and I wanted him to be a little bit not me so that I could get behind him as a mask and explore things that I ordinarily wouldn't explore, but also not make him unbelievable or unrealistic. I wanted him to be like that kid down the block you could be friends with in his design. So tried to keep it simple. I started off with taking a couple of things from another character I really liked that I created called Kino, and he was basically like a little tribal fox. I took some notes from him, and I ended up mellowing out a bunch of stuff, and the first iteration of Kevin was actually as a husky, and then I played around with the concept of a rabbit, and that really resonated with me for some reason. I just really fell in love with it. So then I made him a rabbit. And originally he was a gray rabbit, and then I decided I didn't like that. Kept playing with it, kept changing some stuff. Eventually I ended up settling on him being like pure white with long floppy ears, both because I like magicians and because I was also really inspired by characters like Buster Bunny. So there's a little bit of toon in Kevin's design and a little bit of anime. He's got like a hairstyle that's very reminiscent of like a Sonic character, for example. He's got ears that are very reminiscent of Cream the Rabbit, though. To be fair, I came up with Kevin first. I mean, I don't have a monopoly on big floppy ears. But, you know, that sort of those sort of traits lean one way, and then the more toony traits in his design lean the other. He ended up being a pure white lop-eared rabbit. And then the last name, Snowpaw, ended up coming from my first foray into Second Life. I needed to create this character in Second Life. It wouldn't let you pick a name. You had to pick from a designated list, and that one just popped up. I was like, that's perfect. He's got pure white fur. There you go.
Oh, that was a good coincidence.
How would you describe Kevin Snowpaw's personality?
He's rambunctious. He's very mature for his age, mostly to save me from having to try and roleplay way, way, way younger than I'm normally used to. But I don't really roleplay much anymore. He's a little bit active. He's very much a gamer kid. He does some physical activity. He plays a little soccer. He does a little martial arts, you know, because what kid doesn't do karate in like the 80s and 90s? And I'm a 90s kid. So
yeah.
Kevin does a little martial arts. I mean, he's not the karate kid, but, you know, he can do a kata. depending on the setting he's in, he may or may not have other abilities, but like just the generic, like, suburban American setting I tend to usually put him in, he's pretty much like your average kid. Very much into video games, comic books. His family's casual nudists, though they definitely put stuff on whenever they have guests over. So he's sort of like got this double lifestyle he leads.
It feels like he would fit right in with like the Zootopia environment and like that nudist camp and all that other stuff.
Oh, he'd love that place.
Yep. He would totally grow up in the Zootopia environment.
Absolutely.
About how old is he?
Kevin canonically is 8.
That's a very good age.
I picked it because it was right in the middle. It wasn't so young that he was a little kid, and it wasn't so old that he was a big kid, which meant I could play the field.
Exactly. That's why it's a good age.
Absolutely.
That's about how old we kind of imagine Daniel and his friends to be at school.
Yes.
Yes, around that age.
They definitely look it. It is kind of nebulous because like the way that the game presents the characters, it almost feels like they could be in middle school, but they sure as heck don't look it.
Yep.
So it's very nebulous. But then again, what was the name of the school? I want to say it was
Amoris. Yes.
Yeah.
Amoris.
Amoris private school is very much that. It's a private school. And as somebody who has been to a private school for a short period of time, about 1 year, they can be very different, very different from what we're used to in public school systems. So you have a lot of wiggle room there.
Yes.
Yeah, I went to a private school for a while. It was kind of like a pseudo private school, or it was like a preparatory school or whatever, and you had to wear uniforms and all this other stuff. So I could definitely, that's how I kind of drew some inspiration from it on how it worked. I just think having those characters around that age is great, because like you said, there's flexibility in terms of how they would behave and how they would speak. I know that there's frequently many times where I've gotten better at it, but when I'm writing like Daniel's dialogue, there's times where Dr. S is just kind of like, yeah, Daniel would not use a word like this. He's only 8 years old. He's not gonna say a sentence like this. And he's just like, oh yeah, that's right.
It's really hard to stay in that mindset. Yeah, especially when you have characters like, for example, Alex, who is very immature, and I love it. And then you have characters like Sarah, who is too mature, and I also love it. And I'm hoping that one day soon we will be able to help her remove the stick from her ass. I'm pretty sure that's a plot-centric goal. But
yeah, we can put something else, yes, in there.
I absolutely did not think I would like Sarah as much as I have, but I've ended up really liking Sarah's character development.
I mean, that honestly was kind of our goal. It wasn't like an intentional goal for people to like not necessarily be totally into her character, but it's like she definitely was made in a way where like you weren't quite sure what her deal was, and you knew that she was a stickler for the rules, and you know, kind of wanted to make sure that, you know, things were orderly, and she had certain I think it's more fun when you get characters, when you get a mixture of characters like an IA2, where you have characters who are just upfront about everything, like Alex, or you get, you know, characters like Sarah, who want to make sure that everybody understands the rules and that they're followed and stuff. And so she has like a bit much bigger barrier to break down.
Absolutely.
And then it's a bit more satisfying, I think, for some people when you get to know a character more and get further in their route and see what happens to them.
I'm kind of hoping that we'll get to a point where we can kind of break her. And I know that sounds terrible, and I don't mean it like the way this particular genre, when you say you break someone, it, you know, it has much darker connotations and much more adult connotations. That's not what I mean. I mean that Sarah is a character who is very much cosplaying as a tiny adult so hard that she's completely missing the fact that she's a kid. And you only get to do that once. So I'm really hoping that at some point we will get to break her of that habit. And she probably won't stop being Sarah, but she will start living all of Sarah instead of just the stereotype that she believes she needs to fit inside of. I think that will be a lot of fun, and I'm looking forward to seeing if that's where the story ends up going. But since we're on the subject, I absolutely want to do a shout out to you guys for creating the game. One of my favorite games in the genre of all time has got to be IA1. It was amazing. Yeah, it's so much fun, and it's so pretty to look at. And the themes are just like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, out of the box, out of the park, completely wonderful. Everything I could have wanted out of a game like this, which is super, super rare. And I know it's very difficult because, you know, it's expensive and it's time consuming, and getting an artist to draw all the pictures and do the animations is a nightmare. But it's worth it. But I just want to acknowledge how much I'm not alone in saying this, but many other fans appreciate the effort that goes into one of these games. And then you turn it around after doing the unthinkable. You completed a Lolly Show game. The number of games I have seen that have started in this genre, in Furry and in Lolly Show, but especially in Lolly Show, that never reach completion is soul crushing, because I am a huge fan of the medium, like comics, animation, video games. Those are the mediums I feel are the best for telling these kind of stories, because they're the most expressive. And to see so many of these game projects die in the cradle crushes me. So for you guys to turn around and do the unthinkable and complete the game, it's done. It's a completed circuit, and then turn around and start another one. And yeah, I do lament the loss of the hand-drawn imagery, but you have done such a good job on the CGI that you're using for the character models that I don't miss it nearly as much as I was worried. And it gives you a lot more control over the project because you don't have to outsource it to an artist and an animator. You are the artist and animator. I want to support it so bad. I want you guys to have all the success in the world. It's part of one of the reasons I wanted to come on the podcast, was to talk about games like that.
Well, we really appreciate the praise, and we love seeing everybody enjoying the IA game, and you brought up a lot of interesting things. One of them being that I think the reason why a lot of game projects, especially NSFW ones, though it really applies to Safer Work ones too, the reason why they often don't get off the ground is because, well, number one, they just make it too ambitious.
Absolutely.
That's number one.
Yeah.
Number two is they, and this is probably the other biggest factor, is that you need to make 100% certain that if you're going to work on it with another person or a team, that every single person must feel passionate about the game. Because if you don't, you then will potentially run into issues where they lose the motivation or they aren't as interested in it, and then it causes delays, and then you run into all kinds of problems with that. But then there's also the aspect of just general organization. I think game developers severely underestimate the amount of planning and organization that has to go into making a game, even if it's small scale. Like, even if you're doing just a visual novel, like in RenPy, like how we have done. I mean, Dr. X, how much planning and how much, like, have we done? I mean, we've done countless hours of planning and stuff like that with IA and IA2, like a huge amount.
Yes, and in different ways. Like in IA1, we had we don't have this Google Drive anymore, but we used to, where we had a bunch of different documents for all the routes and then, you know, writing and planning stuff out. So that was number one. And number two, especially for IA2, we would have chats online and voice chat talking about how we wanted the routes to be. And so that's planning, that's organization, especially because we write notes about that. I think Hyder, you're exactly right about what you said. And for the first IA1, we were fortunate that by the time the artist wanted to leave the project, we had already, you know, gotten the major things we wanted to get done. So we were able just to put a nice bow on it and complete the game. And, you know, everyone's story was done. We had the epilogue. We had the pregnancy stuff that people wanted. So it was very graceful. And I really appreciate being part of that. And I am really glad that we finished the game. Just the other day, I was working on a few tweaks to the first game, just to sort of like taking into account certain conditionals. Like if Nate had experience in something and then does another route, we want to make sure that the game's dialogue reflects that. And also if he didn't have experience too. So that, you know, there were a few players who noticed that maybe the dialogue was a little inconsistent depending on the order you do things. So I guess it shows our attention to detail because we're going back to the first game and adding new conditional dialogue for stuff, which is great because it helps make the universe and the game feel more alive because we're still working on it. Even though it's not like major updates, we still really love the game and the characters in it. And I'm excited to eventually get that update in. And maybe people will replay it a little bit for the extra dialogue. There's not a ton, but there is something. So it might be fun for people to replay it. And we'd eventually like to get voice acting in the game, which is, I guess, another...
Been quite an endeavor.
Which would be another milestone, I think, in the Loisho gaming community, is not only having finished a game that's of a pretty respectable size, but also having voice acting in it. So that's one of our dreams. And I think it's achievable. It's, you know, we're still trying to network with people, but it is something we want to do.
I would absolutely love to see that. And it's very obvious that these are labors of love for you. And it shows because even after the game is released, there's, I don't know how big it is, but there's actually a mod community around IA1 that mods things into the game, which I just think is amazing.
Yeah, I really talked to probably the most prominent modder right now, who's Ruddle. He's asked me for a lot of help, and I've helped him with the coding and stuff for the mods. So I'm happy to help with that. You know, I love the fan community. I'm so grateful for it. It's awesome that, you know, people like him, people like Ruddle are modding the game because they love the game so much. And I'm really honored to be a part of that and to hear that people.
Well, absolutely.
If it wasn't for the fans of INI 2, we wouldn't be able to keep making the game because, as we know all too well, the amount of you can't really spread the game far and wide. you have very, very limited scope. But if you can at least have a captive audience in that small niche, it's great. I mean, would we love it if we could have In Sexual Awakening on Steam? Yeah, it'd be fucking amazing. but
it might be possible. There's ways to do it.
there's ways to do it, but of course our game was designed in such a way to be horny, like right from the get go, practically.
The release the game on Steam route and have it be a boring virtual novel, but there's also this offsite patch you could install and suddenly it's not boring anymore. I've seen a couple of games do that.
Yes, exactly. You know, that mysterious patch that we're totally not affiliated with. Yes. Yes, exactly. But, you know, yeah, the point is that, like, yeah, we can't put it on Patreon. We can't advertise it so, you know, clearly or freely on Twitter. There's lots of places where we can't post the game. So we're really grateful for the people who, you know, despite that, still support us. And I remember for the first IA1, we did have it on Patreon for a time, and we were doing pretty well. And then, you know, Patreon said you can't have the game there, and our income, like, you know, shot down so quickly.
Yeah, like plummeted like almost immediately.
You know, we weren't making a lot of money from IA1. We weren't making a lot at all, honestly.
It's a horrible catch-22, because you absolutely deserve for this game to be a success, and you deserve to make a profit off of it if that's what you're trying to do, even if it's just to support the game's future development. But, you know, not enough exposure, you're just not going to get the dollars. Too much exposure and your game's going to get killed by other factors.
Yeah,
I know
exactly.
That at one point you guys got, I think especially Hydro, were feeling quite discouraged on the project. And I don't know if you remember, but I was trying to be one of the more vocal supportive voices, yeah, telling you not to throw in the towel yet, but that I would respect you if you did. I'm so glad you didn't.
Yeah,
because here we are.
Yep.
That was admittedly, that was mostly me, who was having, you know, I guess you could say mental health problems with the whole thing, because it was just, you know, mounting stuff, you know, regarding attitudes towards Loli Show, and, you know, so I kind of had an episode, which is rare for me, but I feel like a lot of creators have those moments of doubts in the Loli Show community because there's just so much stigma and there's so much going against us. But you know, I decided that I did want to continue working on the project because of people like you, Kevin, and Hydro.
Yeah. It was the outpouring. I remember. I still remember it to this day. That we were like, I mean, we both of us were actually brought to tears. We were, yeah. But when we got the outpouring of support from everyone, you know, from the community, and I think that was kind of like one of those cathartic moments for both of us, where it's almost like we had this newfound clarity of that, no, you know what, this is a stigmatized community, and, you know, I don't give a shit what the rest of dumbass society wants us to do or wants us to create. We're going to just continue on with the project. And
yeah,
I'm definitely grateful we did, because we created ShollyCast. We continued on with IA2. And, you know, really the only barrier that's annoying is the financial barrier, because I think, unfortunately, the powers that are pushing back against Loli Show are, they know that the best way to harm NSFW creators is by hitting them in the pocketbook. It's the best, most effective way, because if you can't pay your bills, and you know, you can't pay your rent, can't pay your utilities, because you're not making enough income from something you really enjoy, that's NSFW, yeah, you're going to feel discouraged, and you're going to be like, well, you know, I guess I can just do safer work. And, you know, we did have, unfortunately, a previous guest on ShollyCast that did have that happen to them recently. You know, getting your PayPal shut down or getting your fan box shut down is a pretty significant blow, especially if you've been relying upon that for a long time.
It really is. And it's tragic because the stigma is pointless. The genre's harmless.
Yeah.
90% of the people involved in it want to be the small, cute one, not the other way around.
Yep.
The overwhelming majority of people involved in it are either completely not interested in anything real, or for the ones that are very dedicated to being as hands-off as possible, which, you know what, good on them. The stigma I guess the point I'm trying to make here is that the constant negativity is not going to win, okay? You're never going to beat horny. It's just not going to happen. So all they're doing is making things more difficult. And that's part of why you got such an outcry of support, is that
The
community is small and it's desperate, but it's also resilient because it, along with the Cub community, have been beaten down and chased out of every place and vilified and demonized and pushed into seedy chat rooms and forums on various corners of the internet. I mean, my God, I remember going all the way back to ShowChan and things like that before those sites went down. But it never dies. It always grows back. You can prune it. It will keep coming back. It's not going anywhere. That's why everyone is so supportive of these, because we are desperate to expand the medium. We want more because there is nothing out there for us. We have to make it ourselves. There are no video games out there where you can play as the anime hero protagonist who's also 8 years old and saves the world from the evil wizard and also maybe gets to screw the princess at the end of it. Like, that game doesn't exist unless we make
or have sex with the evil wizard.
Or have sex with the evil wizard, yeah. It's, again, a huge part of the reason why I wanted to come on. And for anybody who's listening right now and thinking to themselves, yeah, I like the game, please, I'm going to say it because these two are too proud to say it. Please go to the Subscribestar. It's dirt cheap to support them. If you can afford the cost of a cup of coffee a month, support them. Because game designers like this are only going to be able to continue doing this stuff if we help them. No one else is going to do it. And to that end, when this episode goes up, I'm going to shout it out on my Ink Bunny page. And I'm hoping people who are into this stuff, who watch me on Ink Bunny, will jump over and will help support you, or at the very least will download and enjoy the game.
Or go on Fanbox, because unfortunately Subscribestar is a little weird with its card payment processing. Then they've never gotten back.
Yeah,
they've never gotten back to me, unfortunately, with what the problem has been. Some people have said that it has to do with the country that you choose when you pay. But yeah, Fanbox though has reliably been good for everybody. So if it doesn't work on Substar, use Fanbox, because what we do is when you subscribe on Fanbox, you then message us on Substar, and what we do is we will then set you up with the according tier. And you know, it's really crazy to think that, and you know, I think part of it is just we like to be consistent, but like, we have never, since we launched the IA2 Substar back in 2020, it was actually December in 2020, we have never raised the subscription price despite all the inflation and all the other crazy economic things that have happened.
You guys have never paywalled either. That's something else I want to bring up.
We never want to do paywalling. Really, like, if IA ever does get to Steam, we want to make sure that, you know, that people realize that they still can play the game for free, but getting it on Steam might get you, maybe like, well, we've been planning some possible stuff out, like a special edition kind of thing. But the other thing is if you're just buying the game on Steam, you're just kind of getting it just to support us. And you know, of course, we greatly appreciate that.
Yeah.
And we would love to see more people play the game, see the game, It'd be really, really amusing to see the Steam community play IA, because that would be something else. Because the Steam community can be something else when it comes to gaming.
We'll see what happens.
But you know what? It's possible for every, you know, if you really dig around in some of the back areas of Steam for some of those games that are a little bit questionable, like that, I think there's one called, like, Succubus Quest or something like that. The main character is basically Shota. And some of the monster girls are, they range the gamut from busty, milfy types to, yeah, that's a lolly. So these games exist on Steam. And again, you had to download a patch. These games do exist on Steam, though. And if you look at the comments, they run the gamut from, ew, what is this? Horrible stuff. Get this off of my Steam, to, ooh, cunny, make the world go round. So there's definitely an audience.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, there definitely is. I mean, there's a reason why Saba, a.k.a. Gagura, got like a million subs in like 1 week.
Oh, yeah.
Their newly launched YouTube.
And one of the reasons why we don't paywall it is because we wanted to create something that we would enjoy even as players, you know, people not making the game. And part of that is kind of giving something to the community. And I thought all about it a lot. And one of the reasons why I decided to keep working on IA2 is because I could tell that the IA series just mattered so much to people. Like, even
really does,
you know,
I've got a perfect example of where this could have gone. There was a game, there may still be a game, but at this point the likelihood of it is incredibly low, but there was a game that was being developed called, I believe, Kiki Quest. You may have heard of it, you may not have. It was fairly obscure. Pretty standard lolly themed RPG. You have a cast of lolly characters, you team up and go on an adventure, but it had some really interesting mechanics. Like, you could choose to have the characters clothed, or you could choose to have them naked, and if they were naked, you got completely different dialogue from NPCs that you ran into. But the most interesting thing was that the battles were basically an NSFW game, complete with, like, animations for, like, kissing, licking, penetration, fingering, the whole nine yards. And the whole thing was gorgeously animated. Some of the cutest art I ever seen, and the game is completely dead at this point.
Well, I have a feeling I know why, but yeah, continue. Yep.
I mean, mostly problems keeping an artist, for one. And then there was drama in the dev team, from what I understand, but I'm not privy to any of that, so I'm not going to speak on any of it. But it was a beautiful example of probably the most excited I've ever been for an up-and-coming game in this genre that just never made it. And I'm hoping that they'll restart it, but who knows?
It sounded like that game was extremely ambitious. I mean, to have a game where you can have the characters be either naked or clothed, I mean, that's doable. But when you get into the mechanics of that, the fighting mechanics, like, you can do all these, like, basically it's sex fighting, that can spiral out of control with how much stuff you have to do.
It worked. It worked like rock, paper, scissors almost. So, like, different characters had different weaknesses, and if you exploited those weaknesses, you could do more damage.
That's still if, like, you had to make, like, animations and different things going on. That's still the people, again, developers making these games don't realize just how huge how huge of an undertaking it is.
Absolutely. There's another one on ATF right now, All the Fallen. If you are a fan of the Loud House, there is a Loud House RPG being developed called Reality Psalm. That's being made by one guy. It is free time. And the demo takes like a couple of hours to get through and is great. Like, I'm desperate for more Reality Psalm. I don't know if we'll ever see any. They keep saying they're developing it. I believe them. But it's a massive undertaking. I'm actually involved in one game as a guest cameo, and in another game as an actual main character. In two games that are being developed right now. One of them is, I don't know if you've heard of it, but there's a text-based exploration game called Life as a Boy.
Oh yes,
I think I've heard of that one.
I think
yes.
I've heard of it.
Yep.
Definitely check that out if this is the sort of genre of game that people listening to this are into. But Kevin is a character in there for a brief period of time. I'm working with the the developers to get more of him because he's sort of like the gateway to like the optional furry content. And then the other one is Lindblom Grade School, which is almost like a Persona-esque first-person RPG. And Kevin's actually a recruitable character.
Oh, that's very cool.
In that game.
Nice.
Sounds nice. Awesome. Yeah, I mean, I really hope wish the best for all the games that you mentioned. It can be very tough for Loisho artists, Loisho creators, because for one thing, as you mentioned, sometimes it's very hard to keep an artist. You know, one problem might be that maybe an artist is not as into the stuff in the game as you might be. So that's one issue. You know, there's also the financial aspect, as we talked about. I also think that one of the reasons why and Sexual Awakening and me and Hydro have stayed together for so long making our games is that we're best friends. So I think I think it's really important for team members to be on good terms with each other. And we've never had any drama between us at all.
No.
Which has been great. And I think, so that's something for people who are currently making a game or thinking about making a game, is that you really want to have a good relationship between the team members, because that'll make not only will that probably make the game better, but also make the game more viable to survive as well. So that's something to think about. And I hope that for any game developers who are maybe having a little drama in their team, that I hope it gets better, and that I hope it improves, because that would really make things safer for the game.
Absolutely. And never forget that even when it feels like it maybe isn't the case, for every vocal fan you have that says how much they like the game, or every detractor who criticizes it or says it's crap or they don't like the genre or they wish you did something different, you have like 10 times that number of silent fans who don't have the, I don't want to say guts, but like they're not the kind of person to speak up. But to the fan base, a lot of these games can mean a great deal. We get very excited over them. We're very invested.
Yeah, and I noticed that when I had my thing with wanting to stop doing it out of fear, there were people who I had never seen talk in the server, Naya server, before, who were voicing their sadness about it, or lending support to us or to me, talking about how much the game means to them. So these are people who might not necessarily normally talk about them appreciating a game, but they do. So that's I think you're exactly right. There's plenty of people who are silent or normally silent about their support and appreciation of the game, but they're, even though they're maybe on the quieter side, they still matter a lot. And you know, the stuff they're supporting still matters a lot to them.
I can't stress it enough. I mean, because like from a first glance perspective, or maybe even from the perspective of a creator, you're thinking, oh, it's just one drop in the bucket. You know, it's one of a million RPGs that are being made in this genre. It doesn't matter if this one dies or if I quit developing it. I mean, honestly, if you don't want to work on it anymore, you shouldn't force yourself to do something you decided you hate. But I cannot stress it enough that I'm serious when I say that the community is desperate for media that we can enjoy, media that was made for us, not just media that we can enjoy because it has things in it we like. Like, oh, I really like Digimon because TK is adorable. And he is. But that's not, TK and Digimon were not made for me. They were made for Pocket Monster fans, which I kind of am, so that's fine, but it's a different genre and a different purpose. These things, they're not for us. So when you make something that's for us, whether it's furry or Loisho, it means a lot to the fan base that game is, or that media or that movie is aimed at. I mean, I cannot tell you how many times I have listened to, geez, what is his name? Ken Ashcorp, Touch Fluffy Tail. I have listened to that song a million times. And it's about Monmasu Quest, aka Monster Girl Quest, which is a Japanese visual novel where you play a Shota and you fight monster girls who basically spend the whole game molesting you. But it's a great game. And if you took all the naughty stuff out, it's actually still a great game.
Monster Go Quest is definitely like, I mean, that is probably one of the super iconic games that is like straight Shota a bit, because I've heard so many people say how much they love Monster Go Quest, and it's kind of one of those games that like bridge the gap a bit for people. You know, people who may not necessarily have been into Shota all the way, or were kind of on the fence about it, that they're like, yeah, but Monster Go Quest, though, I fucking love that game.
Man, the four heavenly bandits. That's all I got to say. If you know, you know.
The other thing is, in a lot of games, even in a game that maybe the developer feels insecure about in some way, there's going to be something in the game that means a lot to someone. And I think in the case of Lolly Show games, I completely agree with you that I think a lot of people are so appreciative and like so much that like knowing that someone made something, someone like them made something for people like them. Now, you know, IA was made by me and Hydro, so Lollicon's Lollicon and Shotokan, both of us, for the Lollicon and Shotokan community. And I think that stuff like that really helps make people feel seen, right? That someone wants to cater to them, not only cater to them, but also is one of them as well. And you know, I it probably makes a few people feel like they matter more than they would otherwise.
Absolutely, it's great to have something you can say is yours.
Yes,
that was made for you, especially when it's something like this, where it's something that the rest of the world would almost rather just didn't exist.
Yeah, exactly. I remember you mentioned before, Kevin, that you also commission art. Can you talk a little about that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So I get ideas in my head as much as I wish I could, you know, get them into reality. I'm not an artist. I've tried. I have no artistic talent when it comes to physically drawing. My artistic ability goes in other directions. So I try when I can afford it, or when I'm lucky enough to have an artist friend who wants to do a request or a gift commission, I try and get art primarily of my character doing various things I'd like to see him do. And he's built up a fan base around that character over the many, many years that I've been growing and developing him. So I try and facilitate artists as much as I can, either through exposure or through direct payment, to have these art projects done. I'm currently working on a couple right now. There's a Alvin and the Chipmunks one that should be coming out, two of them actually, relatively soon. I'm an absolutely enormous Alvin and the Chipmunks fan. Like, my God, if I had to pick a like favorite Anthro boys character, it would probably be Alvin or Simon Seville.
Did you ever see that meme about which chipmunk is getting the best head?
Yes, absolutely. As well as the original art that the meme was based around years before the meme showed up.
What is your opinion? What is your conclusion on that?
God, let's see. I haven't looked at the picture in a while.
Oh, let's all look it up and answer. Everyone answers. Okay.
Okay. Like, I think I could do that. It's enough of a meme. I don't even have to finish this. I just typed in which chipmunk and Google's finishing it. All right, let's have a look. So based off of the expressions, it's got to be Theodore.
I agree. Yeah.
Because that's what I thought too, yeah.
Alvin and Simon both look like they're having a great time. Theodore looks like he just reached God.
Yeah, he's having a religious experience, for sure.
He has experienced the land of bliss. He is standing before the Buddha in a perfect lotus garden right now. That's the expression on his face. Like, he's not here anymore. He's gone, ladies. Theodore has left the building.
Exactly.
Yep.
He's transcended. And you should probably be able to find this with the Google results. There's the reverse version of that. So it's a girl's getting fucked, and then it's the same question.
I think I remember seeing that one as well.
Yes,
but yeah, I'm a huge fan of trying to tell stories through art too. So I will go out of my way to try and do that. Like, I'm currently working with an artist right now whose name is Pucks, and he's an absolute gem. And he is working on a series of images involving Kevin and some of his girls. And I'll actually link you one of the ones that I had done, because I think you guys would like it.
Sure.
But let me look up this chipette thing first.
I'll post it in the chat just so you can see real quick. There you go.
Oh, yeah, that's difficult. Based off of that expression, I'd say they clearly tried to meme them. Like, or not meme them, but mirror them.
Yes.
Similar to the expression that they had before. I would say, this is actually kind of funny. Like, Alvin looks like he's trying to figure out what Simon is doing. Simon looks like he's trying to figure out what he's doing too, which leads me to think that maybe Jeanette has something there that he wasn't expecting.
That would be interesting.
I must analyze this.
Theodore and Eleanor are in their own world. They do not care. So I think they're probably still doing the best. But Brittany also looks like she's really having a having a moment.
Yes. Blown Ahagawa face, yes.
I've always liked that face when it's done well. It's kind of hard to pull off because it could be creepy or goofy.
Yes.
But yeah, like, so I like to tell pictures, stories with pictures. So if I'm not doing like a comic, which I love comics, but they're so expensive, I will try and get a series of images to tell a story. Case in point, this one. I'll go ahead and put it in the podcast chat. And unfortunately, the viewers can't see this, but it's basically Kevin just got bullied by the girl in the background that's raging, and her best friend is basically doing like first aid because she wants to be a veterinarian when she grows up. So she's just making sure everything's okay.
Oh, that's very cute. I like it.
I like it. Yeah, it's cute.
Yep,
we won't be able to show it on the podcast, unfortunately, because we have to take safe for work images. But
well, what we can do is tell people to go on your InkBunny. Will they find this image on your InkBunny?
They absolutely will. They'll also find the image that led up to this and any further images that are done. There should be, I believe, two more in this series that are being worked on.
That's awesome. Looking forward to it. And I think it's so cool that, like, you've built up a following around your OC. I think that's, I feel like that's the holy grail if you're like an OC creator.
That was like the dream.
It was not expected. I was just a guy with a goofy little rabbit character, and I liked trying to get art of that rabbit character, and it just sort of built up around that.
I mean, I have a feeling it probably just came down to you managed to get the formula right. You created an OC that has a nice design, but it's not a design that is, how could I say it? Like, in other words, it's not overly complicated.
It's not a Sparkle Dog.
Yeah, you're right. You're right about that.
Yep. So, you know, artists are able to depict your character and can put them in all kinds of different situations. Well, without, you know, obviously they still have to work on the art, and the art is, of course, amazing and takes a lot of time. But, you know, it would take a lot more time the more complicated the character was. And probably based on that, you were able to tell us right away what his personality was and what he's all about. That is a very important aspect too. Like, if you're so in tune with your OC, I feel like that makes it that much easier to create stories and develop the character. When you're kind of unsure or whatever, that's where it can get tougher. And I think audiences that look at that know it. Well, when they know when somebody is very certain on how their OC is supposed to behave and what they do.
And that doesn't necessarily apply directly to having the art done, but it does indirectly, because personality traits about the character are going to bleed into the art. So the more the artists can mesh with that, the more they're going to be able to make that art really feel like it's of that character.
Yes. And I think not only like having a good design, such as your character has a very good design. It's unique enough, but also simple enough, as we talked about. But the other thing is, I'm sure like there's people who follow your character have an idea of like what kind of situations your character is going to get in, and they like that. They like that your character gets in situations, like cute situations with you know, loli cub characters and, you know, and stuff like that. Very cute, you know, situations between, you know, those cub characters, you know, such as the one you talked about where he's getting bandaged up, and, you know, just, you know, scenarios like that. I think that's probably part of why you have a following, is that people are getting what they want from your character.
I like to try and do a mixture of cute and naughty often at the same time.
Yes.
I tend to find that it's my favorite flavor, if you will.
That's an ideal combo, yeah.
A lot of people are into the darker, more brutal stuff. They want to see bruises. They want to see tears. Big turnoff. I mean, I'm starving over here, so I'll take what I can get. But most of the time, big turnoff.
I get that, yeah. So you have some naughty, more naughty focused stuff as well, but you never really get into like the darker stuff. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, I think the most controversial stuff you'll ever see on my account involving Kevin is that his preferred age ranges can go a bit low. So if you're not into like ToddlerCon and stuff, there is some of that.
I mean, I feel like he's young enough that like going a little lower is not such a big deal. But
not. That's why I think he gets away with it.
Yes.
He's not going to hurt anybody.
But that's cool. I mean, I like that. I guess that might explain part of why you might be attracted to IA, is that we have lots of naughty stuff, but it's also in a very comfortable way, right?
Oh yeah. Yes. Absolutely.
It doesn't make you feel bad or really get into like, you know, abuse and stuff like that. So
it also helps that IA's world and setting is a little bit nebulous on exactly how forbidden some of that stuff is. Like, it's hinted that it's taboo, it's strongly inferred, but it's also sort of slightly suggested that, you know, if you get into the background of some of the other characters, that laws have been passed recently so that like nobody's going to the electric chair for this.
That's right.
And I mean, that was something we very intentionally did, was put more backstory to it in IA 2.
Yes, and we struck a very good balance where you can keep the taboo aspect, which, you know, can make things more exciting, but at the same time, you have the kind of freedom and, you know, comfortableness of it being allowed in the universe at the same time. And I think that makes for a very well-rounded kind of universe as well, where...
Oh yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Where like the player isn't worried so much about, oh, what if they get caught by the police or something? That's, you know, that doesn't happen in the universe. But at the same time, you still have the taboo because, you know, maybe not everyone is down with it.
I eat that stuff up. I mean, I come for the goon, but I stay for the lore. I wanna be able to immerse myself in a world and understand its laws and its rules and its inner workings. Case in point. Life as a Boy. If you dig into the lore of that game, it's heavily suggested and then outright implied in certain places that the original founder of the town was actually pro-casual naturism, and that originally the entire town had no rules against it, and it was only fairly recently that changed. And that's setting the groundwork for potentially later in the game where you might be able to, once you've worked up certain skills your character has and made some changes in the world and done some quests, be able to run around the town in various places, in various states, that sort of thing. Stuff like that drives me nuts. I absolutely love it. I love depth. I love flavoring. Probably why I like D&D so much. It's why my favorite quest in your game is the one involving Sarah going to that political rally.
I had a feeling you were thinking about that one.
Nothing fun like visually or thematically happens during that quest, but the backstory that it sets up, chef's kiss.
I'm glad you like that. It's a favorite for us.
Yep,
as well.
That was all entirely, that was pretty much entirely like Dr. X's, he wrote pretty much all that scene, and then I, like, you know, I tweaked like a few things here and there, but that was a pretty significant scene because we wanted to have something like that in the game. And of course we felt Sarah was the most appropriate character to like funnel that through to, because that would be totally something Sarah would want to talk about and be into.
Yeah, she's definitely the only one of the cast that's going to be all that political. And she also acts very well as a sort of straight man for the situation.
Yes. Yes.
Because if everybody just agrees with you out of the gate and says, yes, wouldn't it be wonderful if this was a thing? Yes, it should be a thing. Let's make it a thing. Okay, cool. Now it's a thing. All right. Good plot development. So Sarah being a little bit of a foil there that you have to get around or convince. Pretty good writing.
Yes, it's all part of the master plan for Sarah. We've thought a lot about it.
I have a feeling that when she finally breaks, she's either going to A, mellow out completely and start being a kid. Mature, but a kid. Or B, she's going to break bad. And I mean, like, full on break bad. Like, like a Higo face all the time.
Double peace sign.
Pretty much. I could see her going one of two ways.
Mm. Yeah, it's going to be exciting.
Yeah, I mean, I remember Sarah was a very, very challenging character to develop in the initial stages because it was just, she was tricky. But she's in a really, she's got a really great, what we've come up with, I think we're very happy about. And I think a lot of people are really going to end up liking her character a lot. If you stick with Sarah, I think you will like, how her route is going to go.
Yes.
I'm doing all of them. So that'll be fine.
Yeah.
I have my preferences. That's
good too.
But I'm doing all of them.
And, Goslin really reminds me of Misty a lot. She's got that red hair.
That picture I linked is drawn by one of my favorite artists. He's Hypnofire 86 on Ink Bunny, but he unfortunately kind of comes and goes as far as his participation on the website, but absolutely does some of the best Goslin I've ever seen. He did a good one of me and Pistol Pete recently too, from Goof Troop. If either of you remember that show.
I'm trying to think who Pistol Pete was from Goof Troop.
I can link her.
Remember.
Sure.
And you can notice a trend with the pigtails, because apparently that's a thing with me.
Yes, I totally forgot about Pistol Pete. She's a super great Lolly character.
So much energy, motor mouth, 500 miles a second. Yeah, absolutely.
It's cool seeing your character in these different styles.
Every artist draws Kevin a little bit differently. And one of the things I really like about Hypno's style is it's so toony.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, I noticed that.
And like I said, his original inspiration was very toony.
You know what's cool, though, is like, your character is going through these different styles, but we can still tell that it's him.
Yes.
We still know that's him.
That's the biggest trick that I've had to keep up, is making sure that he's consistent, and it's not easy. I'll post one up that's on my blog of Kevin and Lily Loud. If anybody listening is into that, you can only find this one on the blog, but if you go to my Ink Bunny, you can find a link to it.
Nice. Now see, he's looking at it different there too, a different style. It's
still very, much
very,
him.
Very cool.
Right, and this is an example of what you talked about before, where, you know, sometimes your character Kevin gets into situations with, you know, notably younger characters as well.
Kevin tends to be he's a switch leaning bottom, especially with other male characters, but he tends to be more of a top with much younger characters.
Mm, that makes sense. I mean, it would be a little interesting if the baby was the top in this situation. I guess it could happen, maybe.
It would definitely be different. I'll give you that one.
Yep. It's like baby Amazon position.
that would be interesting.
I've seen it a couple times, especially when like the tyke involved is especially well endowed.
Mm. Yeah, it could happen. But so your character also gets involved with male characters, I think you said.
Yes, there's quite a bit of that as well. He goes both ways. In fact, I might as well share one of the chipmunk ones I had done that is from an artist called G-Cat, who is one of my absolute favorites. It's the best chipmunk work I've ever seen. But yeah, no, he very much likes that too.
Very cool. So like there's going to be something for almost everyone.
Yeah. For the most part, you'll find something you like.
You won't find something, anything very dark, but if you like cute, you know, naughty, lewd stuff, you'll be in good hands with Kevin Snowfall.
There's some cowboy stuff too, if you're into that. Kevin's a big fan of Westerns.
Yes. Yeah, that's really cool. And, you know, I hope you continue to grow your character stuff, because I'm sure you have fans who want to keep seeing Kevin in different situations with different characters. And yeah, I mean, that's so cool that you built up this universe around this character. It's awesome.
I have no intentions of vanishing anytime soon. I am too stubborn to fuck off.
I admire that. I respect that. I think we feel the same.
Yes. We're going to be sticking around for quite a while.
I hope so.
Thank you. I appreciate that. So if people want to check out your stuff, like, where can they check out your stuff? Like, what are the user, like, URLs or the usernames?
I am Kevin Snowball, all one word, on inkbunny.net.
Okay.
And I believe I am the same on Barog. I think it's at Kevin Snowball, all one word. The only thing that ever gets posted there is stuff I can't post to Ink Bunny, because they have very strict rules on human content.
Right, right. Yes. So if you want the full experience, you should check out both accounts, both Ink Bunny and Barug.
I can't stand it when people have to like shift through 6 different websites. So there will be a link to all of my stuff somewhere on my Ink Bunny.
Oh, awesome. That'll make things more convenient.
Yep.
And it was definitely a pleasure talking to you, Kevin. We had such a great time. I feel like we could continue talking. So maybe we'll do that for another episode.
I would definitely not be opposed to coming back for another chat. You guys are a blast, and I'm happy to do anything I can to try and give you a little bit more exposure in any way I can. I want video games like this to keep moving forward. I'm sick and tired of watching games that I love die in darkness.
Well, you know, we're glad that you are praising us, and you know, that you want our continued success, because we also want, like, you know, people like you that have OCs that are, you know, in the Lolly Shota genre to also, you know, get more exposure and get more people following and more interested in the character. It's a mutual benefit, and we really appreciate having you on.
And I understand you might be working with some developers as well, so I wish you luck with that, and I wish those developers luck as well.
Oh, me too, absolutely. I'm doing everything I can to help them out where I can, in what small ways I have available.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, it's the best thing we can do for each other in the Lolly Show community, is continue to grow together and to band together. That's the most important thing.
Yeah, so thank you for being on. It was your time.
I agree. Absolutely my pleasure. I was very honored to be here. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.